and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. You're watching The Future is Female. This is the show where we find the extraordinary in every woman. So the Asian Pacific Resource and Research Center for Women, or better known by the acronym ARROW, recently launched an initiative to work with policymakers and civil society organizations to improve the lives of women, girls, and marginalized groups in Malaysia. It's called the Gender Equity Initiative in Malaysia. And joining us on the show tonight to tell us a little bit more about this initiative, we have Siva Nandanthiran. She is the Executive Director of the regional nonprofit ARROW. Siva, welcome to the show. It's good to have you here.
Thanks for inviting us.
Okay, so before we begin talking about the initiative, I want to know a little bit more about ARROW and how it came to be. Is it a Malaysian-based organization?
So I think ARROW is one of those Malaysian success stories, if you could say that. It was founded by two Malaysian women about 27 years ago. Mm-hmm. This was in the lead up to the international conferences that the UN was organizing called the International Conference on Population and Development, mm-hmm. or which is known as CAIRO. So and of course the Beijing
Declaration,
as well, mm-hmm. Beijing Declaration, which took place in 1995. So the national level NGOs operating throughout the region felt that they needed a regional body which was able to put forth the agenda, the interests, the nuances from the region into these global policymaking documents.
Right.
So they actually got together and asked for a regional body to be set up, which is what ARROW became.
I love that. Okay, and part of the work that you're doing is this gender equality initiative project here in Malaysia. It's a two-year project, right?
Yes.
And it's a joint venture with the Federation of Reproductive Health Associations Malaysia, also with Justice for Sisters. So tell us a little bit about how this initiative came to be.
Yeah, so Malaysia is a middle income country, and we're aspiring to be an upper middle income country. And still there are some of those issues that continue to dog us. Mm-hmm. And we are, you know, facing issues around adolescent pregnancies. We are facing issues around early and child marriage. So we thought that the Gender Equality Initiative is one way to help bump up our progress with regards to some of these critical issues.
Okay.
Yeah, and so we work with the Federation of Reproductive Health Associations of Malaysia, which actually has a body at each state level.
Okay.
You know, and with Justice for Sisters. Mm-hmm. And the calls for the project is to kind of put a mainstream comprehensive sexuality education and make it available to young people to look at amending the laws around early and child marriage. And of course, to ensure that marginalized communities have their rights respected and recognized.
Okay, all right. So, but some of these issues that you talked about have been, you know, long-standing issues, perennial issues in Malaysia. We've been dealing with this for a while. Why is it now that there's been kind of an initiative? Is there something that tipped the balance, or was there a pivotal point that you decided, okay, we've got to have an initiative, take action, have more focus on this?
I think that because in the last 2 years we've been discussing around the Gender Equality Act in Malaysia, and very often gender equality, and as important as those issues are, right, representation in parliament, representation in cabinet and executive are important, portrayal of women in media, but also we want to look at more of the soft issues, which are basically around the bodily autonomy and integrity issues that girls and women face, you know, on a daily basis. And sometimes these topics seem to be so soft or mired in a lot of the social morality taboo type of topics that it seems impossible to kind of push the bar, you know. So we thought that seems to be difficult, so let's do it.
I love that. And it's absolutely true. You're right. It's mired in social morality. Who is this initiative targeted for? I mean, it feels like, yes, it's about girls and women, but there's so much more because it's such a social issue.
Yeah.
Who are you engaging when you're, you know, within this initiative?
Yeah, so I think that the stakeholders, when we look at the stakeholders that there are, I think the first is, of course, civil society organizations who are involved in the field and equipping them, as well as helping strengthen their capacities to do research and to do advocacy. So that's why we're working with both Justice for Sisters and the Federation of Reproductive Health Associations of Malaysia. But we also want to reach out to stakeholders, because
who
they
are
can
the
be
stakeholders,
so it could be government stakeholders, for hopefully, you know, some of the policymakers who are operating at both national and at state level. I think the media is one outreach that we're definitely
That's definitely a stakeholder. Okay.
Yeah, because I think reporting on the issues in with the nuance that is necessary to make that perception change is something that we are looking towards. So I think that these are generally the stakeholders.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So when we're talking about engaging those stakeholders, what about the community? Because I think about, you know, when we think about social morality, wanting to engage stakeholders at a really grassroots level, religious leaders, community leaders, are those part of your stakeholders as well?
I think that some of those religious leaders we have reached out to. I think we hold like dialogues within the organization and within our network as well. But religious leaders sometimes fall into like two categories. They are the champions, and they are few, they're there.
Okay.
And then they're perhaps the mainstream ones who don't want to kind of lose popularity or take an outward stance on these issues.
Right. The dialogues have been open and engaging?
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
Wonderful.
All right. Very quickly, I also wanted to ask you a little bit about the issues that you are zooming in on, because you mentioned quite a few. Is there a specific issue that you are hoping to highlight or prioritize?
I think that comprehensive sexuality education is waited for a long time to become a reality in the country.
Okay.
And I think that not only because of the adolescent pregnancies and the numbers that were, you know, year on year rising for almost like 5 or 6 years. And I think there is definitely a need for sex education.
What does that mean, comprehensive sex education?
So comprehensive sexuality education actually...
Sexuality education.
Yes. Okay. So it's like, it covers a range of issues, right? I think in the UN stance, it has been called age appropriate. So for example, even as early as 3 to 4, 5 years old, you know, kids need to be taught about things like good touch, bad touch, right? And of course, being taught about things like grooming, because, you know, we have, our kids have access to media, and they have access to technology, they have access to devices. So it's important for us to actually empower them with that, right? Then of course, later on, how to negotiate relationships, because, you know, frankly, I mean, you know, caring for someone else, falling in love, these are all part of the adolescent teenage experience, right? And some of us navigate it better than others. Mm. And the reason we navigate it better is because we had a support system. We had information on how to navigate it. But not everybody has that, right? So I think giving access to adolescents and young people that sort of information is really important and vital for them, you know? So, and it's not only about preventing pregnancy and preventing HIV and STIs infections, but it's also about understanding consent boundaries. And these are actually, and you can see, you know, it's playing out in the media at the global level, it comes, right? So how do we actually teach young people, you know, how do you understand consent and boundaries of another person, you know? When is something considered harassment, and when is it not considered harassment, right? So I think there's a lot of information that our children actually need, because they're not actually going to live only in our house forever and go to school. They will become a citizen of the country, and they'll become a global citizen, you know, so kind of navigating those norms becomes really important.
Oh, wow, that's really fascinating. Can we take a quick break? But I would love to come back to this. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more on The Future's Female. Don't go anywhere. Stay tuned. Well, Welcome back to The Futures Female. I'm Lisa Idris. I'm chatting tonight to Sivananthi Thanantharan. She's the Executive Director of the regional nonprofit Arrow. Siva, you talked a little bit about this comprehensive sexuality education. So interesting. Where is this information, where should this information be placed so that we equip our children, our young people, to learn more about this? You know, what's your recommendation? What is Arrow looking at?
I think that 2 years ago, UNESCO actually came out with global standards. It's called the International Technical Guidance on Comprehensive Sexuality Education. This kind of mandates Ministry of Education to kind of put out comprehensive sexuality education curriculum, which is in accordance with those standards. Mm. So very often people say, well, why don't we go into internet and put videos out there? Yes, there's a lot of information out there. Okay. Some of the parents who are perhaps more progressive, or some of those who have private schools, or are actually utilizing some of those videos.
Okay, so it's out there on the internet.
Yes.
So you have to go look
for that. Okay. Yes, and it may not be accessible to everyone.
Correct.
Right? So this is why we think that Ministry of Education should really, you know, take a very strong step in order to introduce it to, to make it available to all students, regardless of, you know, whether they're rural, urban, whether they come from poorer or lower income communities. We think that that's really
important. Is there anything in the current school curriculum or the syllabus at the moment that talks about consent, good touch, bad touch, about, you know, sexuality? Is there anything at the moment?
Yes, I do believe that some of those elements of good touch, bad touch are already there.
Okay.
But I'm not sure entirely that navigating the issues around consent are there, you know, because of many of the cases that we've clearly heard, right? I mean, for example, gang rapes, you know, or rape of very young girls, or even by their own family members, you know, so clearly that is not a message that is going through all the way.
Mm. Any engagement with the Ministry of Education on this?
We actually had organized 2 years ago a regional dialogue with almost, I think, 15 to 16 governments from the region on this. And all of the different governments were actually putting forth to us, what are the kind of progress they had made on comprehensive sexuality education. And a Ministry of Education officials from Malaysia were also present there. Mm. After that, we had begun some discourse with them, along with many other stakeholders. You know, I think one of the things that we really wanted to remind everyone is that many of those countries in our region, even countries like Cambodia, you know, Vietnam, China, Mongolia, had made so many steps in order to ensure that their students were getting comprehensive sexuality education.
Wow.
So we would be like falling behind, you know. And I think that this is something that really appealed to the ministry at that time.
Why the apprehension still to adopt this?
Actually, you would be surprised, but, you know, they have a sex education syllabus that has been sitting on the shelves for almost like, I think, a decade or more than a decade.
Okay.
You know, but I think it's, you know, the apprehension and the fear that once it goes out to society, it kind of sends a message to society or the conservatives who are in society that somehow we're becoming a very liberalized state, you know, and that would make people uncomfortable. But of course, I feel that the best approach is to engage the stakeholders early on, to try to explain exactly what are the contents inside the curriculum so that there's no misunderstanding, to make parents, you know, at school level part of the process as well, because it's like, you know, parents never had sex education either, right?
Yeah.
So they'll be saying like, oh, does my child really need to know that?
Right.
You know?
And I think it's wonderful that you made the distinction between kind of sex education and sexuality education, because it is comprehensive.
Yeah.
Very, very nicely done. I mean, we could have a whole show talking about this, which I'm hoping to have you back on to discuss this in depth. But I also wanted to touch on, you know, the topical issue of sexual and reproductive health and rights during COVID, during the lockdown, because really there was a lack of access to healthcare services and preventative tools during the lockdown period. What did Arrow observe coming out of MCO now, you know, for the period that we were under lockdown?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, we all knew about the fact that they had shut down the hotline for violence, but they quickly put it back up again. You know, because...
And yeah. good for public vigilance as well
exactly.
as social society, right?
Yeah, and so...
Society,
yeah, right. And I think that the other one that was observable, I mean, this is not only in Malaysia, but across the globe, that violence in the home rose, you know. So this was a global phenomena. The second thing was, of course, when we were faced with a pandemic, many of the Ministry of Health had to actually divide into what was considered essential services and non-essential services. And across the world, you'd be surprised that many of the clinics that were shut down were actually family planning clinics, because some of the family planning clinics are run by NGOs themselves, you see. And so that actually put out a gap in the market on whether women were able to access those family planning services. Number of these NGOs were also catering for sex education or creating youth-friendly services or holding the places where youth could have these conversations, you know, about sex and sexuality. And so those also were kind of shut down and affected.
Okay.
So that was one thing. The other thing that we are seeing, which is quite scary, is that the dropout of girls from schools, you know, which seems to be across the world, this has occurred due to the shutdown of services. And of course, the impact of care work, you know, on women.
Right.
So because suddenly, I mean, I too face this a little bit myself, but I wouldn't put myself in the same situation as many of the other women, is that so women had to sometimes, you had to work from home, you had to work at home, right?
Yeah. And so double burden, isn't
exactly.
it?
And then you had to make sure that all of the meals were now catered for. Previously, you know, your kids ate at canteen or something like that. And then you had to help them with homework. You had to like share technology. You had to share space. So it's really became very difficult for women to navigate this.
Well, that was always existing, but I think what the lockdown did was really kind of double that burden, or really deepen that burden. When it comes to, and I wanted to talk about the sexual and reproductive health and rights, because there were so many jokes made offhandedly about a post-MCO baby boom.
Yeah.
And I feel like those jokes were are, you know, being made without us truly understanding the consequences, the very real consequences of unintended and unplanned pregnancies on the personal, on personal lives, on family lives, on society, on the economy. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that, because often you know, we don't think about families in poverty who have to deal with you know, unplanned or unintended pregnancies. All of that, the consequence of not being able to access reproductive health services.
Yeah, so I think that this is what some of the data shows us, is that, you know, they're expecting to see a rise in unintended pregnancies across the globe because of the shutdown on access of family planning services. But it also has these other effects, right? So this means that there might be some who are resorting to unsafe abortions in order to solve their issues. And the second thing is that the maternal mortality ratio will also rise, because you control that by controlling your pregnancy rate as well. And I think that, you know, I find it this one, because sometimes we don't want to talk about, is that we think that violence in the family is just merely physical violence, but some of that violence is actually sexual violence, right? And whether those survivors were actually able to think, okay, I'm now pregnant, how, where am I going to get my services from, or where is my refuge, you know?
Right.
So I think that that's also one aspect we need to think about.
For sure. I mean, I guess also during the lockdown, financial stress as a trigger, personal stress as a trigger, all of those things triggering domestic violence, and not just physical violence, as you said. And what's interesting, I wanted to ask you about, was, you know, Women's Aid Organization weighed in on that very famous case of the YouTuber and the assault case, which she dropped those charges. And WAO had criticized media reports that suggested that this was a private domestic matter, should be left to the couple to sort out on their own, which is a misconception that domestic violence is a private matter. How does Arrow approaching this?
I think that idea of that there are personal matters that need to be handled within the confines of your home is something that is across so many different issues, right? The reason that some of these issues are actually public policy issues is because women are already at a disadvantage. You know, many women are at a disadvantage economically within the relationship, which we don't talk about.
Okay.
They're also at a disadvantage, you know, socially and, you know, with regards what power they can exercise. So this is why we think that laws need to be created to kind of elevate women's status to be that of equal to men.
So you talked a little bit about the Gender Equality Act in the beginning of the show.
Yeah.
That act is an all-encompassing law. Is that to make sure that there's no discrimination against women? Talk to me a little bit about it, because it feels like it's such a big, broad umbrella, right?
Yeah. So I think that when the NGOs were actually coming to the government and talking about it,
okay,
is because they wanted to have one of these laws that kind of protect women's equality in every sphere. Right? Beyond that of just the Domestic Violence Act, which we have had since, I think, 1994, if I'm not mistaken. And, of course, recently updated as well, I think, a few years back. So I think that this is something that the government needs to look at, because women are 50% of their population. And guaranteeing us equality will actually improve the country, you know, economically and socially, right? So I think that this is something that you know, we need to be very cognizant of, and sometimes it's easy for us to say we are equal. It's something that
we can say is it the truth? You know, in reality,
in reality, we are governed by so many other kind of norms and traditions which kind of hold us back.
Well, there are structural barriers. There are, you know, systemic inequalities that that need to be dismantled before we can achieve true equality. While we were talking about the MCO and during the lockdown of the COVID period, I wanted to ask you how that impacted work, CSOs work, or civil society organizations like Arrow. How did that stop you from doing the work that you were doing before the lockdown?
Yeah, I think that firstly, we saw that many of our partners were hampered in doing their usual work, which is either service provision or capacity building, capacity strengthening at the community level, because you just could not go to those areas, right? So you had to be as confined to your home. The second thing was, of course, a lot of this work is about advocacy. Right.
Okay.
So you need to like meet stakeholders, you need to like be talking to them. And this was also very much limited during the MCO period. The third is data collection. For example, talking to women, doing focus group discussions, or trying to like monitor what is happening on the ground.
Yeah.
So it became difficult for NGOs to carry out that particular specific.
And that data collection is so important,
for
understanding, you know, the reality on the ground.
Yeah.
This and whole thing, sorry, you were about to say.
Yeah, and also like for us, like for example, we would do regional and global reporting, right? So you have the Sustainable Development Goals reporting that takes place in Bangkok through the Asia Pacific Forum on Sustainable Development. You have it taking place in New York through the High Level Political Forum. So all of these became online virtual events.
So it still happened, but it just, you know, had to move online.
And not only that, but then holding your government online in an online forum, or holding government, it's impossible.
Okay.
You know, although it was hard to do previously, but it was seemed to be far more manageable or better. But right now, it's like, you know,
it's difficult.
It's very, very difficult.
And speaking about that, you know, 2020 was really supposed to be that pivotal year where we might see acceleration in the hopeful realization of gender equality. It was 25 years since the adoption of the Beijing Declaration. Has the pandemic, and I know this is a global problem, has the pandemic caused a setback for championing gender equality? Have we regressed in any way?
I think that what has happened was, you know, I mean, you're absolutely right. We were all going to go to Paris and Mexico for generation equality.
This is a really big year.
And I kind of sit on the civil society advisory group to this Generation Equality Forum. But what has happened with the pandemic is that it has really shown the fault lines that exist in our society, right? So the huge inequalities between not only the rich and the middle class and everybody else, right? But also between men and women, right? So the not only the rising increases of violence, the inability of women to navigate the economics, you know, because many of the women are caught in situations where they are doing factory work or they're doing those daily waged work, right. You know, or piecemeal work. Like, for example, you sew one piece of cloth or you sew one garment and you get paid for it. So all of this was gone. You know, so I think that we are really, you know, people think about building back, you know, and we said, well, first we have to ask ourselves, do we really want to build back or do we want to build a new
something new?
You know, so we need to reimagine what society can look for, right? And I'm not sure whether you've read of this donut economics. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people are looking at and say now's the time for us to introduce a sort of economic model in our society which looks at being respectful of the natural boundaries, as well as looking at what can we do in order to bring those who are at the peripheries of society more closer to the center.
Well, what a, you know, wonderful thing to talk about. Hopefully there is an opportunity in this crisis. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much. I've learned so much tonight talking to you in this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
That's all the time we have in this episode of The Future is Female. I will be back with you same time next week. Thank you so much for watching. Good night, folks.